All right, so what I'll do is if anyone logs in, Dan, can you help get them set up? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so we'll get started. Can everyone see my screen?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hello?
I don't know. It wasn't me. Hello?
Is somebody logging in?
Trying to.
Okay, we've got... if you've just logged in, please email dan_mason@sccoe.org, and we'll send you a new login. We seem to have encountered some... Did somebody just log in?
Can you say that again?
Yeah. If you've just called in, we have a new screen. And, okay, so I need you to email dan_mason@sccoe.org, and we'll send you the new login. For some reason, people weren't able to see my screen.
Okay. All right, so do we just log out then?
Yeah, log out and then email Dan, and he'll send you the new login.
Okay.
Okay?
It's a new phone number then, too, right?
No, the phone number is the same.
Okay.
Same phone number. You can listen, too.
Okay.
Okay, you can listen. All right, did everyone hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, this is Dan Mason and Bill Conrad, and we're presenting a webinar, actually a webinar more than a meeting probably, but we will answer questions about the empirical validation of benchmark assessments. Using a system that we've developed here in Santa Clara County and also working in partnership with the Berkeley Bear Center at the University of California. And I want to also acknowledge the work of Diana Wilmot, who is currently the assessment director at Palo Alto, who helped do a lot of the work in the building of some of the tools that we're going to share with you today for the validation of benchmark assessments. So I want to show you some of the resources, because this is going to be a webinar where we're also going to give you a lot of resources and tools that you can use yourself to validate your own benchmark assessments. But we also would be able to provide you with professional development support as well to help with this if you would like. So one of the sites that we're going to look at is our school plan site. And basically, Santa Clara Unified School District has graciously allowed us to use some of their benchmark assessment resources to share what we're going to show you today. And so a lot of this information now is located and data is on our school plan system. And so I'm going to show you the benchmark that we're going to work with is going to be a 2011-12 benchmark, and it's going to be the 7th grade, let me see if I can find this here, 7th grade math assessment. So it's going to be the second quarter math. And so what I'm going to do is refresh this and show this to you. So this is the benchmark assessment that we're going to validate today, represented on the school plan system. But you all have your own. This is not dependent on this system, but I just want to show you what it would look like. And we start with an answer frequency. I'm going to hide this panel. So here we look. You are all familiar with kind of an answer frequency view. And so what this has is it's an item-by-item kind of visualization, and we can look at this by percent correct. Is everyone seeing this?
Yes.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is show you the 7th grade. And that's what, so this is an algebra, a pre-algebra assessment in math that we're going to look and try and validate today. And let me see if I can get this to, all right. I'm organizing it by percent correct. But this is an item analysis, and you can see how they've picked distractors A, B, C, and D. And then you can see the percent correct. And so that's kind of where we start off in terms of looking at the assessment. This happens to be item 17, which we're going to focus on a little bit today. But that's basically the data decision support system that we're going to use. And then we can do various statistical analyses that we're going to talk about as well. And so this system is able to visualize the statistical data for each of the items. So that's kind of the system that we're going to use. In addition to those resources, what we're going to provide you with today would be the actual assessment itself. So we do have the assessment itself in PDF format, so you're going to be able to get that to look at. We're also going to provide you with a protocol. Hang on. So we have a protocol for analyzing the benchmark assessments, and that's a step-by-step process that you can go through to analyze each of the items. You're going to get that. You're also going to be able to get an example. So we have an example filled in using the 7th grade benchmark assessment. So we have an exemplar that you can use and with your teams, if you're working with a team, to go over findings for the various components of the validation process. And then the other thing we're going to provide you with are just some basic tips for designing and using the selected response items. So those are some of the resources that we're going to be working with today. And, of course, we're also going to have the presentation itself that you'll be able to use. So I wanted to kind of give you an overview of all of the documents and resources that will be available to you. And if you're interested, it will appear on our website by in the next 2 days so that you're able to download all of those resources. Is that okay with everyone?
Yes.
All right. So we're going to start then by looking at, we'll start with the deck. And it's Dan Mason. Dan, you want to say hi?
Hello.
Here's Dan. We're kind of excited about all this. And so these are my two sons on either side. And I used to work in Oakland. And so really we just want to make sure that we're supporting every student in our district as if he or she were our own child. And so a lot of the work we're doing, of course, is around helping support student achievement. And so we want to make sure the assessments that we use are the best possible, the most valid and reliable. And so, we always get little pop-ups going on. So do you all see my pop-ups? And Dan also warned me about this, but, you know, we'll probably get an Adobe coming up pretty soon. So just be warned. So we're going to ask you to put your phone on mute unless you want to speak. Sometimes there's a feedback. And then there's a chat function on the system, and Dan's going to be monitoring the chat function today. And then, of course, no emailing during the webinar because we are watching you. We have the artificial intelligence and software to watch you. And we're just going to try and have some fun today.
So,
yeah. Yes?
Nothing.
Question?
No question.
Okay, so those are just kind of the webinar logistics. So some of the things that we're going to try and fix today, or problems that we're going to try and fix, are the idea that, you know, many of our districts are producing benchmark assessments. And the real problem, though, is that we're good at designing and delivering the assessments and analyzing the data, but we don't necessarily spend a lot of time in actually empirically validating those assessments after they're administered. So this is really about an assess for success in which we're trying to find ways to validate the assessments after they've been delivered. Some collateral benefit to all of this is that the teacher teams who initially develop the benchmark assessments can see what items are working, which items aren't working, and they can have more confidence in the assessments as they go forward in using them themselves and with fellow teachers. So that's kind of what we're talking about here, is having a process in place to be able to do that. Now, this actually is a 3-hour workshop that we did, Dan and I did, with Mark Moulton in Santa Clara Unified. So I'm not going to try and duplicate, obviously, that whole workshop. But understand that all of these tools that I showed you and these resources go together as a professional development opportunity for teachers who have participated in the process of developing and using the benchmark assessments for math, English language arts, science, and so on. And this also applies not only to selected response, but these same kinds of classical and IRT kinds of tools that we'll be sharing today can also be used with performance-based assessments as well. Okay? So basically, we're going to start off trying to understand what are the key elements for validating the benchmark assessments. I like to start off with basically, you know, what these assessments are about in terms of helping support kids. So I'm just going to quickly kind of go through some of the opportunities and the roles of assessment and item analysis to support student learning directly, okay? And then we'll look at what are some potential theories of action that could help drive improvement of benchmark assessments. We'll look at some classical statistics around the validation issue of items. And then I'm going to share with you a visualization system called the Right Map that's also very powerful in helping to validate the quality of an assessment. And then we'll look at the role of leadership, hopefully, and then we'll look at what a district assessment review process might look like. Is that okay with everyone? Are we so good so far?
We're here.
Do we have anybody new?
Yeah.
Do we have anybody not seeing the screen? Everyone sees the screen?
I see it.
Okay. Anyone not? Cool. All right. So basically, we want to look at this, the whole concept of what I call the assessment continuum, bringing more balance to the assessments from most formative to most summative. We're kind of in this center zone right here, starting to look at item analysis focused on distractor selection. So some of the work that we do with students individually is around item analysis focused on distractor selection. And, of course, this idea of teaching the dog to whistle, you know, assessments, you know, we thought we were teaching something, but did the students learn? So this is an opportunity using our assessments to determine did the students learn. So that learning rather than teaching becomes really the central issue that we're dealing with. One of the kind of places that I went to, a second grade classroom, and I asked the kids, you know, where they were having problems. And they said, you know, Bill, the main problem we have here is 20 minus 9. And so again, the importance of looking at how kids are solving problems is important. So I gave them some acetate sheets and I said, okay, go ahead, tell me how you solve this problem, 20 minus 9, expecting that they'd all be regrouping and following the way the teacher taught them. So basically, we looked at some kids using their fingers, some kids using tally marks to solve the problem. Other kids would write 20 and count down, so they'd have their own process for solving the problem. And another kid would solve a simpler problem of 20 minus 10 to get 10, and then just add 1 to solve the problem of 20 minus 9 to get 11. So here we're moving to more algebraic solutions at second grade. And so then another kid would obviously use the teacher's technique, thank goodness. So they do the whole borrowing process. And another would say, no. What I would do is add 9 to 20 and add 9 to 9. Then I'd subtract 29 and 18 so I don't have to borrow from the tens. So here's really, truly an algebraic process for solving the problem. And a kid in the back goes, why do you do it that way? And this little girl said, you know, I hate to have messy papers, so I always set up my problem so I'm not crossing things out and regrouping or anything like that. I just set it up in this way so I don't have to cross out. And the kid in the back goes, hey, I like that technique. I'm going to start using it. So we kind of had a little math community building there. But the idea here being that, you know, each of these kids really had a unique way of solving the problem of 20 minus 9. And so a lot of times we can set up our assessment system, even our selected response assessment systems, to elicit these kinds of patterns of thinking in terms of the solution of problems. So again, this idea of the active role of listening, being a good listener as it relates to how kids solve problems is important. And then what we're going to focus on today is helping to listen to assessments themselves to determine how well they're eliciting student thinking and how well they're actually gauging the degree to which kids understand concepts. If you want to learn more about this, And this is something that Diana Wilmot recently gave us from Palo Alto. There's a whole series of short video vignettes on kids solving problems. And it's Marilyn Burns. And it's the MathReasoningInventory.com. And so you'll get a copy of this as a way of staying focused on student thinking and solution of problems. So by listening to students, we can identify error patterns in student thinking and then build the assessment items that incorporate distractors that attract student responses where students may have these error patterns in thinking. And so basically, this is kind of a theory of action that could go forward in the development of benchmark assessments that many of our districts are currently using to bring a more formative flavor or component to the benchmark assessment system. An example, one of the resources we're going to give you is one that Dan has actually written in partnership with some of our other team members, called The Three Facets of Assessment. Is this idea of looking at a question and then building distractors that may attract misconceptions or error patterns in thinking. Here we're looking at a function as an x-intercept of 3 and a y-intercept of 2. Which of the functions below could be this actual function, right? So what we find is that item 15 aligns with a standard, of course. Students graph a linear equation and compute the x and y intercepts, right? So it does have a basis in standards. And I just previously showed you our school plan system, and you can look at an answer frequency for this. And what you see for item number 15 is that a large percentage of the kids are selecting item or distractor C, 39%, and not so many are selecting 16%. So when we look at distractor C, of course, we find that what kids are doing is that they have a misconception around actually applying the formula for determining what the X and Y intercepts would be. And what we find them doing, instead of substituting 0 for Y to get the X intercept, they're actually just placing the values 2 and 3 next to the variables Y and X. So that, you know, we can find out from the actual question itself that what the kids are doing. So that letter C, for example, 2y, 3x, the kids are basically just putting the coefficients next to the constants next to the coefficients y and x. So again, we can make sure that the assessment is able to elicit that kind of a response, and we can determine where kids are having that issue and then design interventions that would help support kids who may be having problems with number 15, letter C. Does all that make sense to everyone? Was that too quick, or? So basically, I'm trying to set up the situation that these assessments do have some type of a formative capability to them, right? And we can use our data decision support systems to help us, elicit those kinds of responses where kids have these error patterns in thinking. Okay, here's the, then of course the kids could set up a table, apply the different formulas, set the x's to 0, and find out what the actual intercepts would be for the y and the x. Now, in the actual protocols that we'll be giving you, we go through this 7th grade benchmark analysis and review, and so we'll actually look for items on the assessment where a large majority of the kids are selecting the incorrect distractor. And so it becomes an opportunity then to see where there may be some error patterns in thinking. Even though we may not have had a theory of action to build those error patterns into the assessments, we can also see where kids might be getting tripped up on the assessment. And it may be a problem with the assessment itself rather than the actual kids' thinking. So we have to keep both of those ideas in mind. A, it could be an assessment issue. B, it could be a problem in kids' thinking. And so the protocols that we're going to give you today have these kinds of opportunities for teachers to go through the assessments and do this kind of reflection. All right, so the next... Does that make sense in terms of the role that the formative role that benchmark assessments play for district schools and teachers?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions about that section? All right, so what we're going to look at next is The idea of when we look at an assessment, what we want to think about beginning is what is the theory of action of the actual benchmark assessment itself. And so a lot of times what we see in terms of the benchmark assessments is that they're designed with like five items per standard kind of thing. Does that sound pretty familiar?
Yes.
All right, but what we're saying is that we may want to have a little bit more refined thinking in terms of what that theory of action might be. So even though an assessment might be built on that theory of action, we might also build in certain thinking skills aligned to those standards. For example, we may have some questions aligned to comprehension, some questions aligned to application. So we could have a range of difficulty going into the assessment, even though it's aligned to a standard. The five questions that we select for that assessment could have levels of difficulty going along Bloom's taxonomy from the whole idea of understanding to application. Make sense? Somebody have their iPhone turned on, or so basically, what we want teachers to think about, at least not even in a post hoc way after the assessment, to think about, was there some kind of theory of action that went into the development of the benchmark assessment, right? So again, this kind of depth of knowledge kind of thing in terms of the assessment. So maybe we want to align them to the standards, but we also want to incorporate Bloom's taxonomy and have a little deeper thinking. We want to have student recognition of math ideas moving to conceptual understanding and ultimately leading to application. Now, this is how David Foster sets up his MARS assessments. So he has some items basically around comprehension. He has some items around the conceptual understanding of the math idea, and then he has some application. Items could also be single step or two step. So we could have a series of single step items, multiple steps. Or some items could be aligned to more challenging standards than others. So that what we want the teachers to think about is a little bit more refined or in-depth ideas around how the benchmarks can be set up. So what we would do is we have our 7th grade math assessment, which I previously showed you just briefly. What I would do is we would have the teachers actually look at the assessment itself and try and determine if there is some kind of theory of action other than alignment to the standards within the assessment. And oftentimes they'll see that, yes, there are single-step and multi-step questions, or there are questions that are different levels of Bloom's taxonomy. What we then ask the teachers to do is to come up with some findings about the theory of action around the assessment. So basically, we're going through this exemplar of this 7th grade assessment, right? And we're trying to see, is there some kind of theory of action associated with the assessment? The purpose of this is that when they go back to their assessments that they've developed, then they can begin to think about, was there some kind of theory of action in their assessment, and so on. So they found that there are several potential theories operating within the assessment, the items were aligned to algebra, functions, measurement, and geometry and number sense. So their theory was a prerequisite for students to do well in algebra is to build upon their number sense abilities. Thus, it'd be expected that the assessment items would be aligned to number sense would be less challenging to students than items aligned to algebra 1. So they can start making hypotheses, too, then, about which items really are going to be more challenging for students to solve, so that when they do the empirical analysis later, they will be able to see items that they thought were challenging may turn out to be not challenging for them, or vice versa. Are you following me? Is everyone with me?
You told them to put it on mute.
Did you put it on mute? Everyone's on mute. Okay. So then we can have also problems 1 through 8 are examples where they are solving purely mathematical problems, and then there can be some application problems as well. So basically, the teams will just kind of begin to review the assessments for this theory of action. Now, I also have them review the items as well for quality. So I remember I showed you the tips for quality. So in addition to looking at theory of action, they're also looking at the items just from the perspective of, are they written in a quality way? Are the stems well written? Are the distractors appropriate? Is there bias in the items? Make sense? So that's really our first shot. And so then we come up with some findings. So if there's no explicit theory of action that underlies the assessment, maybe they can see some actual potential theories of action in the current items that reside on the assessment. So we made some findings for problems 11, 12, and 22. The problems on the test require students to use multiple steps to solve them. And they thought that these items would be more challenging than the ones that were single step. And then they thought that the items aligned to number sense would be more challenging than the Algebra 1 items. Okay, is that clear? So we kind of warm up, get familiar with the assessment, think about some theories of action, and then just look at the quality so that they're more or less familiar with the and get reacquainted with the assessment itself. Okay?
Okay.
And then we begin to look at, okay, well, let's look at some of the classical statistics for the items, all right? And the first one we look at is, okay, let's look at a point-by-serial analysis of the items themselves. So Mark Moulton has kind of helped us. He's from Berkeley and helped us come up with a definition for the point-by-serial correlation statistic, which differentiate items based on whether they classify students in the same way as the test as a whole. So basically, kids who do well overall on the items but have difficulty with certain items, those items would be considered difficulty if it's consistent. In other words, if all the students who did well have difficulty with a given item, that item would be considered difficult, right? And students who perform well over on the test would also perform well on the items, or they would have a high probability of success. So students who do not perform well on the test should have a lower probability of success on that same item. And so a strong positive point by serial would corroborate that theory. It corroborates the fact that kids who do well on the test would be less challenged by the easier items, and the kids who didn't do as well on the test would be challenged by more difficult items. So that theory is corroborated through the point-by-serial. And so the more positive it is, the more that theory is corroborated. So we can look at the data from that perspective. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Okay. So when we look... So when we look at a low or negative point-by-serial, so... it means that there probably may be some issues with the item. Not 100%, but it's certainly worth looking if you find an item with a low point by serial, say 0.13. It's worth looking at that item to see if there might be some aspect of the item that is creating a challenge for kids who overall did well on the test. All right? So what we found when we looked at our data decision support system and we looked at the point by serial on the right, we found that item number 17, which is aligned to mathematical reasoning, had a point by serial of 0.13. So that immediately became kind of an area for an item for us to look at for possible difficulties. And I did the little twirl thing there. So none of the other items demonstrated a very negative or low point by serial. So overall, the items on this particular test were pretty good, so that's a good thing to celebrate. But this item 17 had a negative or a low point by serial for all of the 7th graders who took the test, meaning that kids who generally did well on the test, right, and who should have gotten this item right as an easy item did not. And so there must be something going on with that item that is interfering with their ability to do well. So let me show you item 17, see if I can find it. So if we look at item 17 on the actual test itself, and we have this available for them to review, if you look at item 17, so the question was, state whether the number is prime, composite, or neither, and the number is 91. So that got them into a pretty good discussion about the quality of this item. with number 91 not being a prime number, but it's not an easy prime, you know. It's not an easy non-prime. And so they felt that this was more of a tricky question for the kids to actually wrestle with. Many of them just thought that it was A. So when we go back and we look at the actual results for 17, for item 17, we find that, you know, 41% of the kids, only 41%, are picking the correct answer, which is it's a composite number. And 51% of the kids are picking the prime. So the point by serial immediately gives us the opportunity to go right to this item and begin to interrogate it. We don't have to go through every item. I mean, right away we see that number 17 is going to be an issue on this particular test and we'll need some work. Okay? So, yes?
Can I ask you a question about the point by serial?
Sure.
How do you, do you differentiate between the percentage of students that actually get the question right with a low point by serial and, say, students, a low percentage of students getting it right with the same point by serial?
Oh, because this, we have to look at this from the perspective of a population of students who took the test, right? So this looks at the whole aggregate of everyone who's taken the test. And it is able to rank the kids who did well on the test, right, on a continuum to the kids who didn't do well on the test. So then the items can be then matched up against their performance, right? So that... if many of the most of the kids who had an overall high performance on the test get the item correct, right, then it can be considered generally an easy item, especially when compared to kids who did not do overall well on the test, got the item wrong. So the combination of those two factors together creates this ratio or this number called the point by serial for that particular item. So we have to look at the whole context of this overall population taking the test to come up with this point by serial.
Could you explain the way that you have split the groups? You talk about a student who performed well, comparing that to a student who did not perform well. What is that cutoff for performing well? Is that better than 67%? What is that?
I think it comes out of the item response theory and the algorithms that they use, looking more at the probabilities. So what it's not necessarily absolutely that they're going to get it correct. The idea is that they have better than a 50% probability of getting the item correct. So what it does is it really looks at the probability factor more so than whether they got it correct or not. So it's really a distribution of probabilities around what is the probability of this particular child based on how they overall did on the test to get this particular item correct. And so kids that will be categorized based on their probabilities of being able to get that item correct based on how overall they did. So if they would be, say, greater than 50% probability, that would be kind of average. But if you moved up to 70 to 80% probability of getting that item correct, then that would be considered to be basically an easier or less challenging item for that particular kid, based on the probability. Okay, so moving forward. So the other thing, find this point by serial based on the probabilities, find items that have low point by serials, and then what we can do is actually we can create a scale score for the items themselves based on these ideas and based on these probabilities. We can actually look at and give the items themselves a scale score. So in the same way that we give the kids a scale score, we can also give the item scale scores. And so when we find items that have very high scale scores or very low scale scores, they would become items that we may want to look at in terms of their level of difficulty. It may be that they're appropriate, they have a high level of difficulty, and that's our expectation, and that's fine. But it may be, in fact, that there may be an issue with the item itself. Is that making sense? Yes? All right. So when we look at, for example, number 17 again, we see that it gets a scale score of difficulty of 402. Compared to the next level, the next item, which is 337, 322. So this item really is falling in the high proficient, more or less high proficient range of performance, meaning that it's challenging. It's challenging, and there's a lower probability for most kids of getting this particular item correct. So again, it's another indicator for number 17 that there's probably something going on with number 17 for kids who did well on the test are still challenged by this particular item. So it's another indicator. By giving this the items scale scores, we can actually be able to find out which items are more difficult or challenging for students. And they become indicators we need to look at those items. Follow? So item reliability is the third classical statistic that we look at. And so this one is a measure of how well the item is able to reveal differences between high-performing students and low-performing students again. And the two quantities are brought together into what we call item reliability. So the students themselves can be spread along a continuum of high probability of getting the item correct to low probability of getting the item correct. And we can look at this as another statistic for indicators for items that are working well or not working well. And in this case, again, we see item 17 coming in with a reliability of zero, another indicator that the item has issues. So those are kind of our classical statistical systems that we can use to help identify items that are working or are not working. So again, indicating that number 17 is going to require some work. The last area that we want to look at is called the right map. And this is a way where we talked about that we can give the items a scale score. We can look at the scale score of the items compared with the scale score for the students. So I'm going to show you a visualization that can be done called the right map that helps us visualize the overall performance of items on the test. And so your packet that you'll get will contain some examples of right maps that we can look at, and you can find samples in our three facets. Again, the idea being that there's a theory, generally a theory of action for the assessment. This particular assessment that I'm going to show you has basically six areas of complexity, going from simple linear problems up to trigonometric polar parametric problems. So there's obviously a built-in level of difficulty for this particular assessment, and we'd expect that the simple linear questions would be less challenging than the trigonometric questions, right? Okay? So when we look, what we can do is produce a map of the performance of the items themselves by assigning them scale scores according to how well the kids did on these particular items. So when we look at the distribution of students, the students themselves get distributed based on their scale scores. Going towards the top, these are your more advanced students. In other words, they did well overall on the test, and the students at the bottom would be students that did not do well overall on the test. And each X represents 14 students. The items themselves, then, are also placed on the same scale. So you can see that an item that we predicted to be relatively easy for students, question L1A, is relatively low and that most kids did well. But this L1A just means that there would be a high probability that the kids would get it right. So this child would have a little better than 50% probability of getting L1A right. And the item pretty much fits where it should fit. When we look at L1B, it's in the grouping of simple linear, but the item itself, it has a high standard score and is out of whack with where we would anticipate it would be relative to the level of difficulty we had or the theory of action going into this test. So L1B is out of character, so to speak, when compared to the other items in this section. Does that make sense? Are you following me? Everyone? Do we still have people?
So, yeah, I'm sorry. My phone died, and so I missed part of it. So.
Okay. So basically what we're mapping the items, right, to what we have thought would be a level of difficulty. So we think that these items would be more challenging. So in L3B, if we follow across, the kids in this area that I'm highlighting would have a 50% chance of getting L3B correct, right? And it's fairly challenging for the kids below this level. So it's in about the middle range. And it's in the middle range of the difficulty characteristics. For level 6, which are polar trigonometric problems, L5 and L6 are perfectly positioned. They are very challenging for most students. Only 14 students that would have a 50% probability of getting these two items correct. They would have much higher probability of getting all the items below, which is expected. Students here would have a lower probability of getting these correct, but it matches our theory of action, right? Similarly, we find a multi-step linear problem, L2A, may be a bit too not so challenging for students for some reason. We may need to look at L2A as not being challenging based on our theory of action. And L2C, possibly a little too challenging, it should be somewhere along this line or gradient of difficulty. So you can see how this right map, by assigning standard scores to the items, we can plot the items versus student performance and get some idea of how the items themselves are actually performing. Okay, this is another benchmark assessment. And so again, we can actually put the numbers on the items and look at student performance with kids who are more advanced on the test being higher on the scale. Kids lower would be more challenging. So, for example, most of the kids are coming out in the orange area and would have a 50% probability of getting 12 and 22 right. But you can see there's a generally nice distribution of the items on this assessment, with the items being going from less challenging to more challenging. They're not all down here. The items are spread out on levels of difficulty based on the scale scores. So that's a generally nice distribution. Here's an example of an assessment that was used as a placement test. And they had originally set 80% as a cut score, which is at this level. And there's only one item that is really differentiating kids in terms of their performance. Most of the items are below the cut point and really are not informing the decision, really, to place kids or not place kids. You would expect if people are going to make a decision about placement that most of the items would be at the point of the cut point. Mm-hmm. And we're not seeing that. And there was also a theory that kids would have less difficulty with procedural items than with analytical items. But you see, are they either one more challenging than the other? Are the analytical items any more challenging than the procedural?
No.
Not really. So these kinds of systems, right, visualizations, help folks see after the test is administered whether or not the assessment is appropriately challenging for the students. And are the items distributed in such a way that we could actually make a legitimate decision about placement? Here's another example of the seventh grade test that we just went over. And you can see it's broken down by the three areas that are four areas: algebra and functions, mathematical reasoning, measurement and geometry, and number sense. And you can see that the items for number sense, right, do kind of fall into the theory that the teachers had, being that they were less challenging for students. But when we look at the items for algebra, do we see much difference?
No.
No. These items are falling in the basic range, below basic and far below. And yet we have lots of kids performing at high levels, proficient, but there's no items challenging these students.
Right.
Okay. Except item 17 over here, right?
Right.
Which is a flawed item. So basically what the teachers did is they took and said, we've got to work with these items to make them a little bit more challenging for our students. Because our students obviously are not getting the kind of, we're not assessing our students for the kinds of challenging ideas and concepts that they really are capable of. And this visualization helps to show that very clearly. And the school plan system that we use actually can produce these maps. So we find that most of the items on the right map do not match the distribution of student performance on the assessment, indicating that many of the items are not challenging enough for students. Some of the items, such as 17, are out of whack, which we already saw from our classical statistics, and really they're not challenging, it's just a bad item. So some recommendations: we want to improve the rigor of the items that require application of math content and skills, possibly consider that they all involve multi-step solutions, and then review item 17, of course. So that's really what we find is a powerful tool to help do a post hoc analysis of a benchmark assessment by applying the right map to the assessment. We can look and map the performance of not only the students, but also the items vis-a-vis the students. Any questions? Because we're kind of approaching 4. And Dan didn't think I could get through these slides. I swear, he didn't think.
How many more?
We got about 20. But no. but basically, that, you know, this, we presented this to middle school and high school math teachers in Santa Clara Unified, and they were really able to do a nice job of wrestling with these classical and IRT statistics in ways that were easily visualized. And so we would be happy to provide you with the resources that we used, if you're interested.
Yes.
Okay, so we will, and then basically the role of leadership would be that, you know, our administrators in Santa Clara Unified were beautiful in the way that they organized the teachers. They organized the middle school and high school teachers, so they went through our exemplar in non-grade-alike groups. So they kind of organized the whole day in a way that was really effective and efficient for achieving the results that they wanted to achieve in terms of improving their benchmark assessments. So we had a day where we actually went through this exemplar, and then they went through and had the right maps and all the classical statistics for their own assessments, and were able to make modifications in a focused way for the items that they felt were, or that they knew from the data, were not performing well.
Yeah.
All right. So those are some of the things that the leadership was doing to help support the work. You know, we are available, Dan and I, to help plan a help you, you know, refine this. There's only so much that we can do in an hour, and you can see this is a relatively complex topic, but we think it's an important topic. And we do have, being evaluators ourselves, we do have a website, so we'll send you this website if you'd be so kind as to complete the evaluation. It will help us move forward.
Sure.
Yeah. Is there time for questions?
Sure.
This was excellent. Thank you. In terms of additional test items, when we, like, for instance, item number 17, you run into an issue where our item bank doesn't have additional additional items that may be comparable or be a replacement. Mm-hmm. This is a very, very practical question, but
sure.
What resources and tools would you recommend for more for developing or even or additional test banks?
Well, we basically, on our school plan system, we have an assess builder system so that teachers and the folks that are developing these benchmarks can go in and create their own items. So that would be an option if you have, as part of your data decision support system, if you have like an assess builder that allows you to go in and modify and change the items, which these folks did have access to and could do.
Or, the teacher could always, or a teacher, I mean, this wouldn't work for a lot of items, but if you just had a couple items that you wanted to change, you might pose that to your class as an open-ended question and see what type of responses you get. You know, that gives you your distractors there, too. Kind of use it as a cognitive lab.
Going back to your idea of uncovering what the student thinking is and then creating distractors that might go down that path.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
But we did get big pushback from the high school math teachers around that because they said, hey, wait a minute, you're fooling the kids, you're tricking the kids then, you know? And this is a summative test that they're getting graded on, and here we are putting basically traps into the assessment to capture their misconceptions.
Right.
And so, but we got some big pushback there. But I said, really, if they have that misconception, they have the misconception. And so, whether we have just kind of a neutral distractors or distractors that are going to elicit error patterns, either way, it's informative.
That's right.
And that was our point to these teachers because they were using this particular test in a very summative, grade-like fashion. And our point was you get the most bang for your buck if you're, you can use it summatively, but use it as formatively as possible.
Right. I also came in a few minutes late, so show a slide on tips for quality. Did I miss that?
Yeah, I'll send you this. What we have is we've got a bunch of resources that we want to send you. So we've got tips for building quality selected response items that come out of the book that Dan wrote, actually, called The Three Facets of Assessment. And so we've got things to consider generally, design tips, specific tips for selected response, bias guidelines, and then some actual examples. So we'll send you that.
Great. So we'll get all that automatically as a participant in the webinar?
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah, it is. Thank
How many webinars can you go to where you get actual stuff?
I know. Great.
So, yeah, we're all about the content. We're not about, all this verbiage about, 21st century learning skills. We're actually into providing practical, useful resources and tools. And they could be even 18th century stuff. We're not so against 18th. We kind of like the 18th century, actually. No, just kidding. So we'd be happy to come out. And then we also have our school plan system. So I can show you some of that, too. We have this grade 7. So when we look at, we've got the statistical analyses that we can do. And then here you can see we can actually, we're going to produce the actual write map right now. It's actually producing it. So here comes the write map. Hang on. Is it coming?
I logged you out.
I think I logged out because I haven't been in. Haven't been in.
Because I was surprised that you were able to even get that link to happen.
Right. But it will actually produce the write maps that I showed you. This system actually will take this data and produce the actual write maps.
Now, this is a school city?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they've partnered with us and Educational Data Systems, EDS, to come up with this, what they call EdScale, which kind of is a higher-end item analysis tool. And, you know, the nice thing about this type of professional development, another a byproduct of it, is that it just feels like the teachers, they're not as threatened by looking at this data, because you're often, you can take a whole assessment and just narrow it down to, three to five items, really, and get a lot of great discussion out of that.
Right. So this would be... So we use ORS as our data management system, and this could just migrate the data over to that.
Or we can actually produce the right maps for you, because we have the software from the University of California, Bear. So we can actually take your data, as long as we can get item level data, we can actually produce the right maps for you.
Okay.
But not for free, right, Dan?
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
So or you could use this system to actually produce it as well. So see, this is so it wants me to come back. What is our password, Dan? It's DMM. Hang on. 221. All right, so. Yeah. And that's what he was. So that was, he was right, as per usual. So what we want is we want to get back to that 11-12, right? And we want to get the 7th grade. Is it? Here it is, 2nd quarter. Then we're going to go down here to the answer frequency. And it does it by grade level right now. So if we go to 7th grade, and now it'll let me produce the right map. Possibly not. Oh, here it is. So here's the actual map that it produced, right? And so you can see the number 17 right here.
Yeah.
And then here are your students. I think we have about 9 students per X. And you can see that most of the students are performing in the basic and the proficient region here. But we don't have any items, really, except this number 17 that's challenging these students.
Right, right.
And this is kind of the mean right here.
Do you provide the right map along with the biserial analysis?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you get that as well.
Yeah.
Can we just close that, or just...
Yeah, just down below.
Oh, just go.
No, I don't want to hog the time. I just want to, we're about to we're about to revise our benchmark starting next month. This is our first year with these new ones, and we want to do a good job. Can we contract with you guys to kind of walk us through or walk me through this? I mean, we get our data, we get the right maps, and can we hire you to walk through some of the data with us prior to the meetings?
Yeah.
Sort of on a consultant basis?
Absolutely. Yeah. Where are you from?
From Roland Unified School District.
Okay. Where's that?
It's in Southern California, just east of Los Angeles.
Okay. Yeah, so can you send me an email? Shoot me an email?
Yeah, I will. So I'll wait to get that packet of materials and then just respond to that email. Is that right?
That's great. I'll have samples of all of this, the answer frequencies, and you get a chance to see that. And you can see the statistics is sitting right there, right?
Right.
The point by serial. My screen layout isn't that good. Hang on.
If you go down on the right hand side,
right here.
Like, yeah. You can bit.
All right, here.
There you go.
All right, so here's where you can see some of the what we talked about, this the scaled score of difficulty, the reliability, and then you also get a view of the actual student performance by item. And you can see right away items that are coming up that were challenging or difficult just from the percentage, but then it tends to be corroborated by some of these other classical statistics as well.
And all that sort.
Right, it's very, very powerful. I think it'd be great for the teachers to see that and to sort of, and to work through that together in their course elect teams.
Yeah, our teachers at Santa Clara Unified were very, you know, math teachers aren't easy to satisfy. So they liked it because they could focus on the few, overall the assessments were good generally, but there were issues. And so they could focus on those issues and repair those issues. They liked that.
Yeah, we just contracted with ORS, and they use Key Data Systems, and it's a new test bank, mm-hmm. and teachers, so it's been a whole year of working through these new tests, and there's a lot, I think it's, there's a lot of skepticism about the items.
Okay.
This would be perfect to really sort of have a transparent view of statistically where each item falls on these scales.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good because we take it from just a ballpark view of the thing, just take a look at them, look at the theory of action, look at the just basic quality, and then look at the classical statistics, and then the right maps just blow them away in terms of when you are actually able to visualize overall the performance of the items. They just, you know, it's like, wow, you know?
Yeah. I imagine. Okay.
And then that, I mean, they were converted. I mean, we had teachers in Santa Clara in the science who felt that their performance assessments weren't that good, but when they looked at the distribution of the right maps provided, they gained more confidence in the validity and reliability of the assessments that they were working with. They saw some issues like between the rubrics 3 and 4 where things were kind of clumping together, not the items weren't really differentiating around 3 and 4. They went back and reviewed their rubric to make sure it was able to differentiate student performance. And the next time they did the right map, it came out clearly that there was a clear delineation between performance at those levels.
Right.
So it was empirically corroborated that what they were doing was, you know, working.
It's also a very elegant way, I think, to frame a conversation about student thinking and uncovering what's going on in the mind of a student.
Yeah. Yeah. And so. Also the idea that, you know, what you think going in is may not be what is happening coming out.
Yeah. That's true.
That's the big epiphany that occurred. My God, the one teacher was in Palo Alto. I don't want to give names, but they were like, holy cow, our procedural items are just as easy as our analytical items.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that epiphany, like, happens.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, I will wait for your email then and then respond back.
All right.
From there. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else still with us? Anyone else? All right.